It's the World Federation edition of Radio Free Thinker. This week, a rant about affluenza, and we take a look at the World Federalist Movement. Let's begin episode 237.
It's time for Radio Free Thinker, the show that applies skepticism and critical thinking to everyday issues. The place where reason and reality cross sword for politics, religion, economics, and of course, science. Now let's get ready to be skeptical.
The cosmos is also within us. We're made of smart stuff. We are aware of the cosmos and know itself.
Across the sea of space, the stars are others, and we have traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
Hello and welcome. It's me, Don, your political philosopher and political science, skeptical philosopher and political science. You know, I've got a new guest in the house, and she was just talking before the show about how unprofessional certain podcasts can be, and here I am just making a fluff of it. I apologize. So joining me today is Vivian Davidson from the World Federalist Movement. Welcome.
Thank you very much, Don. It's a great pleasure to be here with you tonight, and I appreciate the invitation. And it's fantastic. And no matter what blunders happen, it's always good to have shows like yours. So thank you for the invitation.
No problem. I'd like to start off with introducing my audience to a new disease that may be running rampant in the mansions of America. It's affluenza, the illness of having too much money and the power it grants people in an unequal society. It seems this term was invented when it was used as a defense in the trial of one 16-year-old Ethan Couch in Texas. Ethan, one night, got very drunk, three times the legal limit, took a truck from his dad's business, and with some friends, went out and ultimately plowed into a stranded vehicle, killing four people and injuring several others. The defendant's lawyers came up with a defense that Ethan was not responsible because, quote, the teen's parents should share in part of the blame for the crash because they never set limits for the boy and gave him everything he wanted. The psychologist who testified to this defense later went on CNN to defend this diagnosis. He pointed out that the children of privilege suffer from improper moral education. The term highlights an issue in parents, particularly of the upper middle class, although I think upper class is more appropriate, who not only refuse to discipline their children, but actually protest when others make an effort to do that. For example, school officials, law enforcement, or the courts. Of course, if we take this parental supervision argument to its logical end, then children of the poor are also suffering. Well, if not from affluenza, maybe from povertyitis. Parents who are working three or more jobs haven't the time to morally instruct their children or properly punish them for transgressions. Okay, we can also take it the other way. If the parents share in the responsibility, doesn't that make them sort of accessories to the crime and thus chargeable under the law? Now, the Ethan himself, what he actually was, his punishment is he has to spend 10 years in this sort of counseling treatment center on probation, where he's going to do things like yoga, learn how to cook, horse riding, personal counseling, nutritional things. I mean, he's taken away from his parents, apparently. Actually, that's another weird thing. This particular treatment center has only keeps people for like 6 or 9 months. And this is the first time that they're going to have someone for 10 years. And there's doubt whether that will actually happen. But should there be sort of a separate system of justice just because these parents, they have the money? The cost of this facility is $450,000 a year, and his parents are paying for this. These parents have the money to send their child to this treatment center. In fact, everything about this case has to deal with wealth. From the team of lawyers that were hired, the psychologist who invented affluenza, to, again, their ability to pay for this treatment center that he's being sent to. Let's compare it to, quote, justice for the rest of us who live. A 14-year-old child who punched a guy who fell over and accidentally hit his head and he died from the fall. This guy was given 10 years in juvie or prison. Now, here's the kicker, folks. I kind of agree with this verdict in that the other youth who was convicted of murder and was given a prison sentence, well, one thing the psychologist who invented affluenza said is that it makes perfect sense. He's saying that, you know, anything he could do to prevent a child from going to jail, he was willing to do. But, of course, what's wrong about this is that Ethan had the money in order to do this, whereas the other kid didn't. If it was an equal system, you might be able to make that argument float. In fact, this actually only exemplifies the innate inequality in the world. And actually, this nicely ties in with another issue about inequality. Our own James Moore, Minister for Industry, bragged that we have a very wealthy country and that, you know, everything is running quite well. And yet, when pressed about child poverty, he said that it's a provincial issue and not a federal one. When pressed, he said, "It's not my job to feed my neighbor's child." I don't think so. So he apologized. He said the comments were sort of taken out of context. So let's see if we can listen, assuming I got this queued up right. It's been one of those days, folks. And we'll see if we can get it in context.
We're not going to usurp the province's jurisdiction of that. But how one certainly scales and defines poverty is not quite an apples-to-apples comparison all across the country. There's no question. Prosperity is up. Unemployment is down. Unemployment is down in every region of this country if you look over the past few years. Slightly up, but look at where it was 2 and 3 years ago. More Canadians are working now than ever before. 1 million net new jobs have been created across this country, and through economic growth, obviously, you create more prosperity, more opportunity for everybody. We've never been wealthier as a country than we are right now. Never been wealthier.
I'm seeing kids going to school hungry.
Well, obviously nobody wants kids to go to school hungry, but we want to make sure that kids go to school with a full belly, but is that always the government's job, to be there to serve people their breakfast? You know, empowering families with more power and resources so that they can feed their own children is, I think, a good thing. It's the government's just my job to feed my neighbor's child. I don't think so.
I think the really telling thing about that is that laugh at the end. I mean, it sort of shows the mindset that people like this are working. I mean, he said, you know, that Canadians are becoming more and more wealthy. I must wonder who he pals around with in order to make that sort of statement. Most of the people I know of barely can keep afloat. But it's that idea that, you know, society is, it's just a bunch of individuals, that we need to take our own responsibility for it, and that the idea that we should share or care about others is laughable. It shows that how out of touch our current government is. So affluenza may actually be a real disease, but not so much of the individual, but of a society where a rich minority can't even conceive of the hardships of the poor majority. And any comments, Vivian?
Well, no, I actually absolutely agree that it's one of these unfortunate crises of, you know, the federal government and provincial and federal discords. And I think if we can't look out for one another as individuals and are looking at the problems we have as individual versus state versus federal, whatever, I think it's one of those crises of governments that we have at a worldwide level that we can't really know on whose jurisdiction anything stands. And as world federalists, that's something that I'll get into in my talk later, but that's something that we're trying to curtail, that make every person count as an individual and not really as a state or a federal or a city municipality issue, but one that we're all humans, and it's the brother and sisterhood of humanity, and that's what should matter.
Excellent. Well, we'll be right back after this break and learn what is world federalism.
Oh my. Become a friend of CITR and get great discounts on Commercial Drive and in other areas at
Bone Rattle Music, High Life Records, People's Co-op Bookstore, Audiopile Records, Bad Bird Media, BAM Merch Canada, and the Vancouver Music Gallery.
Wow, it sure does pay to be a friend of CITR. To find out more, visit us in room 233 of the sub on the UBC campus, or go online to www.citr.ca.
Keep smiling, keep shining.
On Friday, December 20th, it's the 6th annual Kingfisher Blues Christmas Party, featuring Needles and Pins, Beelines, Tally Ho Ho Ho, Village, Gal Grayson, Sean Mrazek Lives, Zen Mystery Fog, Tim the Mute, and Cool.
Do you remember that whole little road? 'Cause I think about it every night. It's the only thing left of you, and I gotta get it out of sight.
Plus, you get a free 7-inch record at the door. Tickets are available at Red Cat Records, Neptune Records, and Zulu Records. Sponsored by CITR.
And we're back. So as I said, joining me is Vivian Davidson from Vancouver branch of the World Federalist Movement of Canada, and one must assume eventually of the world. So the World Federalist Movement, when did it get started? What is it? Why is it?
Great. Don, well, thank you again for the opportunity to be here and share with our listeners, you know, what World Federalism is and why it's so important, especially in today's world. So I want to start off by first of all giving you sort of a little statement that the status quo is not an option. That's one thing. And the other thing that comes to mind is Einstein himself. A lot of people identify with him as a scientist and physicist, etc. But he was a great, great sort of global social thinker, and he was a great humanitarian in his thoughts and his ideas. And one quote that I really, really like from him, it goes that you paraphrase, of course, is you can't solve a problem with the same mind that created it. And the problem we have right now in the world are basically very globalized. And so we can't really solve the problems of today, globalized problems, with the same nation-state mentality that we have since the Westphalian system in the 1600s. So that's kind of a little bit of the background, and that there is an alternative to the present state, current status quo system. That's kind of a little bit of my background to what world federalism is. But more specifically to your question, world federalism, international law actually is not a new idea. It's centuries old. But the World Federalist Movement, WFM itself, was formed in 1947 in Montreux, Switzerland. And basically, it arised out of the horrendous atrocities of the wars and the need for there to be something to curtail war and eventually lead to sustainable, long-lasting peace. But the 1929, actually, Pact of Paris outlawed war, but there was no implementation. Like with most things, it was a good idea, but with no implementation, it went nowhere. And then much later, the Nuremberg and Tokyo war crime trials, they tried national leaders, and that in itself was revolutionary. But there's a little bit of a statement or kind of image that comes to mind. It's the worldwide deaths from violence and conflict and easily preventable diseases is almost like an Auschwitz every 6 months. So that's actually what the World Federalism is about and why we're trying to create this kind of global parliamentary assembly, as what we call a global parliamentary system, to go beyond the nation state system to solve problems that are globalized in scope.
But correct me if I'm wrong, isn't one of the maybe impetus of the group or not, was the failure of the League of Nations, which was also sort of intended to do this sort of thing, right? So how is it going to be different? I mean, the UN is there, the UN has been working fairly well, but how? What's the different twist on it?
Well, I'd like to start by saying the UN is not working very well, and that's okay. one of our main issues with the UN is there's a huge campaign we have right now. One of our biggest campaigns is what we call the UNPA, United Nations Parliamentary Assembly, which is to try to democratize the UN. Because what's plaguing the UN right now with the permanent five members who have been there since 1945, and I don't think any other system politically especially has remained intact for over 70 years. I don't think anything is as anachronistic in our political system as the UN today. And the same problems that plague the League of Nations are, I think, very similar to the problems that plague the UN today, which is basically the nation-state model and mentality. As long as nation-states rule in their own interest and with their own agendas in mind, problems really don't get solved because there's this competition, as there is within the permanent five members of China, Russia, U.S., U.K., France. They vie for their own interests, for their own agendas, and obviously nothing gets done. And that's one of the main problems that the World Federalists are trying to address. So there's this supranational organization, like they go above the nation state level that we see today to solve issues on a global scope that can't be solved by one nation individually. It's almost like trying to say, well, Vancouver, you have to solve all of Canada's problems. Not very realistic and not very likely. Nonetheless, that's what's happening today, and obviously a lot of problems aren't getting solved for that reason.
So again, maybe I misread in your the notes that I got from your website. You said this assembly would be, quote, a world conscious and watchdog, but it doesn't actually have any power in that it would sort of, you'd still keep the existing UN structure in place. This would just be another added body. And allow me to put on my Rush Limbaugh hat here, as uncomfortable as it may be, but isn't this just another pinko boondoggle that will accomplish nothing but give a few members of the liberal elite cushy jobs?
Very good point. And that's one of the main criticisms, actually, that we get with this campaign. And my question to that is that, my answer to that, rather, is that we would have enforcement. This actually UNPA would be a first step into our overall goal of a World Parliamentary Assembly. So this would be a consultative body in the beginning, because obviously everything has to start from somewhere. And some people within the World Federalist Movement believe that sort of the World Federalist model in and of itself and the World Federalist government or assembly is too lofty of a goal for the way things are now. So a UNPA would be kind of like a step to get eventually beyond the United Nations state. And one of the premises of establishing a UNPA is that it would have, originally would be mainly for consultation, but that eventually it would have the enforcement and the legitimacy, because it has legitimacy from the citizens and from the people who democratically elect the people to run in the UNPA, it would have enforcement. And that would just be one of the initial stages to the eventual World Parliament Assembly establishment.
So let's say, I accept this sort of utopian-type influence you hope it'll have, right? Well, what is democratic in one jurisdiction isn't really democratic in another. So if you compare Canada, the U.S., India, China, Iran, these are all sort of, quote, democratic societies in their own views. So if this parliament were to be elected, how would you deal with that?
Well, that's what we think is democracy in its purest level. One person, one vote, and direct citizen involvement and direct citizen participation in the election of their leaders. So basically what the UNPA or eventually World Parliamentary Assembly would be that every person and every citizen, ideally, of course, would have a vote, which means that they would have a direct say in what the parliament does and how it runs itself. So that's the purest form of democracy, is that citizen involvement. So, of course, everything is subjective, and one person's democracy is not another person's democracy, but we're not really getting into the nitty-gritty of democracy. We're just saying it's in the most pure of forms, one person, one vote. And every person, regardless of race, age, gender, whatever, is a citizen and worthy enough of having a vote in what goes on in his or her life. And
so,
the world.
So would these elections be carried out by the UN?
Well, we don't know at this stage. I think at this stage, it wouldn't really. We're trying to get away as much from the UN as possible, because in its current state, it's very, again, biased by the Permanent Five and the General Assembly and all these things. So if possible, it would be a sort of an institution aside and on its own and independent from the UN. But I mean, of course, all these things are still in the figurative stages, and it's still kind of in the theory stage, because we haven't gotten there yet. And that's something that we're working on, is making it more mainstream and garnering more attention so that it does raise the awareness of people around the world.
So, okay, let's take that maybe then the other direction. So let's say you get Europe, North America, and 10 other countries to sign on to this sort of parliament. Would you then create the parliament? Because it wouldn't really be representative of the global population. I saw a really curious map that showed this circle around sort of India and China, and said more people live within that circle than without. So at what point would you consider this parliament to be valid?
Right. That's a good question. And I think the issue of population always comes into question, right? Because again, would it be regional? Would it be by nations as they are now? Would it be? And that's a question that we grapple even as World Federalists. But I think something that needs to happen is that there needs to be widespread awareness of it. I think it's still very much in its initial stages. And World Federalism is something that is very popular, again, right now in the European Union, in North and South America. Still in its initial stages in Asia and Africa. So I think what we're doing right now is campaigning to raise awareness in as many countries as possible, and then globally work together to maybe ratify some kind of a signatory process, where if we get a certain amount of the population votes, not really so much of the government votes, to have this adopted. But I think that right now we're pretty much in the infancy of World Federalists, even just getting awareness of who we are and having people be more readily. And I think the time for change is ripe. The time for change has never been more immediate, and especially with our economic and global environment crises. World Federalism, I like to believe, is the glue that puts everything together. There's all these like hodgepodges of organizations doing wonderful work, like with peace and with the environment and with the banking system, and all doing wonderful initiatives and campaigns on their own. But I think World Federalism, as far as I know, is one of the only campaigns that works to put it all together, because we tackle education, global education, we tackle global the climate crisis, and the economic crises. We try to think of ourselves, as a solution to all these problems, not just the hodgepodge problems. So I think in my mind, that's what makes World Federalism so appealing for me, is that it's something that will help put all this together.
So just a little bit of pushback maybe.
Sure.
Because you mentioned this is in its infancy. So isn't it a bit of a leap to say that we can solve all the problems when we haven't really even figured out how we're going to do this?
That's exactly it. And I think all of this, again, this is our vision is to be able to solve, and especially, and not all the problems, because something that's actually part of the Federalist tenet is that we would respect national sovereignty. One of the main criticisms we get of World Federalism is that, you'll just be another state, another hegemon, you know, telling all the nations what to do. But that's actually incorrect. That's not a very good understanding of what federalism is. With our federalist model, we would leave nations to solve issues that are pertaining to their own nations and their own constituencies. But the issues that are global, like security, environment, like things that have become globalized nowadays, like the environment and security and economy and all that, need an institution and a framework that goes beyond that. So actually, what getting back to your question, this wouldn't be the elixir and the solve all of all the world's problems. It would be the solution, we think, of the globalized problems that one individual or group of nations on their own don't have the ability and or the will to solve because of their national self-interests.
So one of the key aspects, I think, of international governance is the idea of international criminal court. I mean, the idea that, right. if someone commits a crime, quite often, a nation state may not be willing or able to bring that person to justice, but there should be something that's sort of above the pettiness of a nation state, like the international criminal court. So what is the Federalist opinion about the international criminal court?
Well, actually, the International Criminal Court is something that as World Federalists we're very, very proud of. Especially the Canadian section had a great influence in creating this treaty. As a matter of fact, Lloyd Axworthy, when he was foreign minister, he appointed Philip Kirsch, who guided the discussions in Rome. And Axworthy himself praised the World Federalists for the role in coordinating the group of these 35 other NGOs. And of course, the ICC is a wonderful idea. But again, because it's so plagued by nation states and the leaders of these nations, it often doesn't do as good of a job as it should. A lot of the problems that end up happening is, again, the enforcement as well. They don't have the mechanisms of accountability and follow-up and enforcement that a world institution like the ICC needs in order to be effective. So a lot of things in the end look good on paper, as many things have in recent history. But when it comes to enacting them and actually ratifying them, it's a whole different issue. So
some have criticized the court for some very basic failings when it comes to the idea of rights. So the idea of trial by a jury of one's peers, protection from double jeopardy, the right to confront one's accusers. What are your thoughts about these particular failings of the court?
Well, again, not to get too much bogged down by the little details of the ICC and all that, because as World Federalists, I think something we have is a very global perspective. I think a lot of things that do tend to be wrong with a lot of these international systems is that more regulatory mechanisms are needed. A lot of things that don't end up happening is because there tends to be a lot of inconsistencies with the way things are originally set up to do. Like the ICC was a great idea, but in the actual everyday, processes of whether we try individuals or whether we try larger cases or whether, things you mentioned, it's actually a little bit more, as I say, loosey-goosey, because again, a court date can be set, but whether they have the enforcement to prosecute or whether, they start talking about state infringement on national laws, all these things get so muddled and everything that there needs to be a consistent basis and a consistent regulatory mechanism to say these are the rules, everybody applies by them or nobody does. And I think that's one of the failings of a lot of international systems is that as long as they're run by nation states, even if they try to be as legitimate as possible, A lot of things don't get done because of these national self-interest and the interest of the people and the higher echelons of the society and of the policies, right? So that's one thing that as World Federalists we try to do is step back and look at the forest for the trees. You know, a lot of people look at the trees and focus on the trees, but we're actually looking back and saying, you know what, there's this huge forest out there that we need to look at. You know, we need to be, you know, we need to stop being boggled down by all these little, you know, factions and discrepancies and conflicts between these nations, and just step back and say there's a larger issue that needs to be addressed. Our technology has globalized our world in many, many ways and has globalized, and the original nation-state boundaries as they were originally set are no longer existent. You know, I think right now we're nation-state boundaries are more blurred than ever before because of globalization, and I think right now we're readily able to communicate with, you know, halfway across the world in a matter of seconds with the internet, and so many things have become globalized, including our problems. And there isn't at any level yet anything to solve these global problems that, you know, that I've mentioned. And that's actually what the World Federalists are about. It's about stepping back and taking a look at the wrongdoings and the what's weak in the international level, and trying to address that with the creation of a global parliamentary, you know, assembly or people's assembly or whatever.
I think another criticism that also comes up with the IRIS is sort of the racialist sort of nature of the court at times, that the vast majority of cases that come to them are from African countries against other Africans. And while there's not an absence of non-white ones, it's definitely disproportional. I noted in your examples on your website, all the countries mentioned were African. Yes, there are some preliminary ones that were not exclusively African. Doesn't this show sort of there's an innate bias in any global system where power is not equally distributed, that any global system of governance will ultimately just reinforce the current dominant structure?
That's true to the extent that the institutions weren't democratized first, but they weren't democratically elected, and the World Federalist System would be democratically elected. That's something to say. And another thing to note is that the chief prosecutor currently is an African woman judge from Ghana, and there is still no arresting capacity, and that's one of the biggest biggest faux pas, I think, of the system itself, is that there is no arresting capacity. And something like the UNEPs, United Nations Emergency Peace Service, that the World Federalists are advocating for, would be a possible sidestepping of this problem, right? And something that comes to mind, like that also, that your question reminded me of, is that most of these cases are actually brought on to the ICC by the victims themselves. So the fact that there is this huge caseload, a huge number of cases being brought on by in the African region, is in large part due to the fact that most problems that come to the ICC are from people in Africa facing these injustices. And so I think one of the biggest things that we have to focus on is, okay, sure, there's this huge ratio of cases from Africa, but a lot of the problems that we're seeing right now, whether it be Sudan in the past or now, you know, like from anywhere from Egypt and Sudan and you know, the Democratic Republic of Congo and you name it, you know, right now there's so many problems. The hub of them right now tend to be in Africa. So there's of course this higher incidences of cases from Africa, because a lot of the major problems are in Africa.
But isn't it also one of the cases that's one of the few areas left where colonial, to use a charged word, have the ability to go in and step in? I mean, right now, France is in the Central African Republic, right? So the fact that the Western powers can go in there and act as policemen, but they don't do the same thing in like Myanmar or, you know, Burma, that sort of thing. But getting back to maybe I think the essence of that is that, you know, the world is not an equal place. Would one of the preconditions for this democracy to work? I mean, the United States is a democratic country, right? And they elect it, but it farly does not actually create a governance system that represents the people. So would you need to have pure equality or a form of equality before this parliament could even exist?
Well, the way we would actually prevent any kind of sort of hegemonic nature to rule over the world parliament or world the world government institution would be basically the one, like what I said before, the one person, one vote. I think a lot of systems in the States, and for example, is a presidential system. So, I mean, in and of itself, you're electing like one president, and there's like the electoral college and all these things. So, I mean, democracy, as you said, tends to be different in many ways in many different countries. But I think something that would make the world a world government more legitimate and accountable is that it would be one person, one vote. And so it really wouldn't be this case of like, okay, well, I don't know, you know, you have more money or you have more people or you have more clout or you have, it wouldn't be this issue of like who has more than others. It would just be one person, one vote. And we're trying to take the individual as one vote, not any nation, not any group, not any party. It's just one person, one vote.
And no, I think, but the American Congress is one person, one vote.
Right.
But it gets severely manipulated because people can be manipulated.
Of course.
Right. So you get a warping of the system.
Right. Well, I mean, people are likely to be manipulated and likely to become, if you want to say, evil from one way or another, right? And I think power and money have always corrupted people. But I think something that would, in my opinion, be more pure about the world federalist system would be that it'll be accountable. It'll be accountable by the people and for the people. And there would be other people directly elected from the constituencies of the world, basically, that they would have to keep checks on. And I think a lot of in the initial stages, the UNPA would be directly elected parliamentarians. So they themselves would be very familiar with the parliamentary system. And this would be a system that would have a lot of checks and balances in and of itself because it's directly directly linked and directly legitimized by the people and not by any one party or any kind of lobbyist organization or anything. So that's actually what the World Federalist Model is about.
So we're going to go for a bit of a break. I'm going to leave with the perhaps incorrect but leading question. I don't remember seeing anywhere on the website anything about human rights. So when we come back, we'll see just whether I'm blind or not.
The best tool ever devised for understanding
the to subscribe to the Radio Freethinker podcast and take it on the go and download previous episodes, subscribe via iTunes or at radiofreethinker.com. Remember to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at CITRRFT. If you have any questions, comments, or thoughts to share with us, email at info@radiofreethinker.com.
Understanding empowers you.
How much do you know about bikes? Everything? Perfect. Nothing at all? Even better. At the UBC Bike Kitchen, you can use our space and tools to do your own bike maintenance, get one-on-one instruction on how to fix your bike yourself, or drop your bike off for us to repair. You can also buy a fully refurbished, guaranteed used bicycle, or a variety of new and used parts and accessories. The Bike Kitchen is UBC's nonprofit, student-owned, full-service bike shop. We're located in the basement of the Student Union Building. Just look for the stairwell on the north side of the sub across from Gage Towers, or search for the UBC Bike Kitchen on Facebook. Stop by the Bike Kitchen and then get riding.
We're back. So, human rights. Do Federalists have any rights?
World Federalists? Well, World Federalists, you mean people have, you know, human rights. Of course, every person has human rights. And something central to a World Federalism is, like I've mentioned before, that every person is an individual. And every person has rights. And every person, regardless of background, race, gender, nationality, ethnicity, religion, has equal rights. And
so, yeah. So the World Federalist Movement supports the UN's national, the Human Rights Charter.
Of course, the United Nations Declaration of Human Rights. As a matter of fact, there is inequality in the world, and revolts are caused by revolting circumstances. And and the world federalism are concerned not only with the human rights, but with the achievement of the Millennium Development Goals. And something that is something we really look into is the fact that just for instance, the world right now is spending $1.74 trillion, that's with a T, trillion dollars in military expenditures. And if just a portion of that, a small minute of that, was allocated to achieving and helping achieve the Millennium Development Goals, then this world would be a much different place, a much better, happier, and healthier place. And one of the tenets of world federalism is that if world assembly or world government was to be in place, it would actually help kind of allocate, you know, the a bit more proportionally than is now or than is envisioned by current institutions. It would help like more justly and equally dole out and apportion money to countries to help solve these global crises like, you know, famine and lack of education and et cetera that are still to this day, despite the trillions and billions of dollars that are being exchanged by countries and governments that are still happening. You know, there's poverty, you know, extreme poverty in some places of the world, and while there's extreme and I think gross wealth in other parts of the country. And I think that inequality is something that we hope will be curtailed, and if not diminished altogether, I mean, if not erased altogether, at least diminished by having an institution at a global level that can better and more justly proportion and allocate this money for better purposes.
One of the planks of your global governments is based on the Bretton Woods project. There's a lot that could be said about Bretton Woods, and we don't really have a week to go through it all. But that being said, one of the aspects that I know of is that it in many ways made capital, that is money, a lot stickier to a nation. It was a lot harder to transfer money from one area to another. And yet, we live in a world now where this system has broken down and capital can go quickly anywhere in the world, while at the same time, people are essentially imprisoned in their nation state of birth. So how is Bretton Woods fit into this project of yours, and tie in the idea of immigration, that although capital is free-flowing, humans aren't, and humans can't ever really be free-flowing. I mean, there's innate stickiness that my friends are here, my house is here. I can't just pick up tomorrow and go to China for the jobs, or pick up and then go to Luxembourg, whereas capital can.
Right. Well, this whole economic thing is actually very interesting, and just a little bit of a background. And the Bretton Woods system was actually formed in 1944, and it was the first example of a fully negotiated monetary order that made to govern monetary relations between independent nation states. It ended, however, in 1971 when the U.S. pretty much unilaterally terminated the convertibility of the U.S. dollar to gold. In 2008, right after the economic crisis and bubble bursting and all that happened, there was a call for like what was referred to like a second Brentwood Woods like system. And in 2010, actually, I'm going to read a little quote by Prime Minister, the Greek Prime Minister Papandreou, who said, "Democratic governments worldwide must establish new global financial architecture as bold as a Bretton Woods and as bold as a European community and as bold as a European Monetary Union and fast." And something that, as world federalists, we very much support is something that I don't know if you've heard of, the Robin Hood tax. It's also called, the financial transaction tax.
Tobin tax, I think.
Yeah, exactly. And what this would be basically is it would be like in the website they say they have a quote that says, "A small change for banks and a big difference for the world." And it's more along the lines of what world federalists see as a more just economic monetary order for the world. It's actually supported, not surprisingly, by David Suzuki Foundation, for instance. Basically, this comes out of the notion that after the bubble burst, millions of people lost their jobs and people got deeper into poverty, the richer, you know, all that stuff. And so it seems that the G20 governments, they seem to focus so much on saving the banks and all these financial institutions, and billions of money are given to them to bail them out and all this stuff, and yet little urgency or money is given to social and other crises like the climate change and all that stuff. And so the Robin Hood, the idea of the Robin Hood tax is that it's time for financial corporations to pay their share of the cost of recovery. And so basically little things like this would be what would help will help curb destabilizing financial speculations and what you call like the stickiness of currencies and all that stuff. And it would be Canada between 1998 and 1999 passed a private member's motion to rally for this tax. And it passed by a glaring amount. It passed 164 to 83, I believe. Yet currently, there's no government interest at all, despite the three opposition parties boldly supporting it. And so I think this is another example where nation-state interests get in the way of supporting something that has the potential to be beneficial at a global level, that it would take a little bit of the billions of dollars that are traded on bonds in the stock exchange every second and allocate some of that to help fund like packages to help reduce poverty, to achieve the Millennium Development Goals, to all these, you know, wonderful things that aren't really getting as much attention from nation states, because obviously they're more interested in bailing out banks than in helping their own citizens and the people of the world.
Well, one of the things too that's often an argument against the Tobin tax or Robin Hood tax, whatever the term you use, is, you know, it's going to hinder development because, you know, money won't be able to move across. But it's important to remember that this is like 1% of 1%,
exactly.
Right? And the only people who really get affected by this are not someone who's wanting to invest in a factory in Ontario. It's the people who sit there and they buy $1 billion worth of euro bonds and then quickly sell it off for American bonds and quick sell it for Canadian bonds in like fractions of a second, because you can make a fraction of a penny on it. And it's sort of reckless capitalism at its heart. And it would stop that gambling on the market, but because they only make fractions of a percent profit, which amounts up if you're dealing with billions of dollars. But it would stop that one, and it wouldn't do really anything to stop real investment. Which leads me to ask, so are world federalist communists?
Well, just a little backtracking on the taxes. You're absolutely right. The taxes is pretty much a short term. It makes short term speculation more expensive, and so then it's a 0.05% tax on financial markets and transactions, which, as you say, is like pocket change for a lot of these global corporations. And and what do you mean by the word by communist? Can you specify more what you mean? Because communism obviously means many things.
Communism in this particular context means, well, A, the end of market-driven forces, perhaps, maybe it's more socialist, the abolition of, not abolition of, worker-owned industries as opposed to capitalist-owned industries, perhaps the abolition of private property to a certain degree. I mean, so, you know, where on the economic scheme of things does a world federalist support? I mean, obviously it's much more egalitarian than a neoliberal would be. But how far the other way does it feel comfortable saying that we support?
Well, I think world federalism, when I think about it, I really don't think about it being a very strong economic kind of institute. Like, I mean, it's not something that it's more of a global sort of philosophy and institution. And of course it would have some economic underpinnings and it'll help stabilize, you know, a lot of these gross inequalities and income gaps and et cetera. But I think world federalists would be more than communists. I think they're utilitarian. It's more like the greatest good for the greatest amount of people, you know. And I think, of course, I mean, there are a lot of economists in the world federalist movement, and there would be a lot of details and a lot of things going around and how to better help the world and stabilize economies. But I think as it is, the world federalist movement, again, is stepping back and looking at the forest. You know, I think a lot of things, once the world federalist, not if, but when the world federalist government or assembly is established, all these things would have to be established. You know, I think would have to be laid out in detail. I think is what I'm looking. The words I'm looking for is because right now it's there's really no set blueprint. Of course, because since it hasn't happened, we can't really get into all the nitty gritties of what would happen financially and economically. But I think what is clear and what is a fact is that we would have a lot more consultation and a lot more civic involvement, and it'd be a way more accountable and legitimate system in my mind, because it would have the direct input of a lot more people than most, if not all, or the organizations that exist today. So it's basically stepping back and looking at the orchestra instead of the instruments, you know, that a lot of institutions do right now. And those instruments, of course, being either nation states or corporations or or whatever. And so I think as World Federalists, we work very closely with other NGOs and non-government organizations and international organizations. And our hope is that when a system like this happens, a World Federalist government, that we're able to work closely with like-minded organizations who have the interests of the people and the citizens at heart. And however that ends up looking, whether it be a Bretton Woods system or Robin Hood tax or whatever, enact certain policies that would help achieve these goals and these Millennium Development Goals, for example, that help the greatest good for the greatest amount of you know, as possible, right?
Mm-hmm. So another program you have on there is what I would call perhaps the Global Parliamentary Assembly, GPA, Army, although you refer to it as the UN Emergency Peace Service. So what exactly is this peace service?
Right. Well, the peace service basically is an idea. It's like almost having a reformed police service for the UN. Because right now, currently, as was seen appallingly with like the Roma Dallaire in Rwanda and like a lot of other instances, unfortunately, there hasn't been that enforcement to be able to say, okay, well, you know, this atrocity is happening in this part of the world. Now let's go in and do something about that. If there's no mandate, if there's no like all these legal things, nothing gets done. And unfortunately, that's at the cost of millions and millions of people. So what, as World Federalists, something that one of our campaigns, as you say, is the United Nations Emergency Peace Service. And what this would be like a police service for the United Nations. So it would have the ability to sort of like enforce and efficiently enforce a rapid deployment. It would be able to, and along these lines, actually, is the responsibility to protect something, another World Federalist sort of issue that we work on and policy that it's R2P for short, responsibility to protect. So I think it's a responsibility of the global community to help one another and the people of the world in times of crises where one nation state doesn't have the ability or the willingness to help its own people. So I think along those you know, they work kind of in tandem. So the responsibility to protect, part of that would be having a rapidly efficient force to deploy with the enforcement and the mandate at any time to go into these
regions. Just to be clear, we're talking troops with guns and tanks and whatever force is necessary to enforce the edicts of the PA.
Yeah, it's like a peace service. Exactly, it's like a police service, almost like that. But because right now, I think unfortunately, peacekeepers, that's another issue that is very contentious right now, because you know Canada is something. There's always, you know, been at the forefront of peacekeeping and since Lester B. Pearson and, you know, the Suez Canal and all that stuff in the 50s, it was at the heart of what it meant to be Canadian. And unfortunately, with the government we have now in place, it's something that has gone to the wayside and whatever. But I think maybe one way of sharing the burden, so to speak, of peacekeeping, and that's one of the arguments against peacekeeping, is that, you know, there's too much money being diverted to peacekeeping forces and not to our own, you know, national causes or whatever. There's many criticisms of peacekeeping, but I think one ability to kind of, again, make equal and a lot proportionally and more justly, if you want, the cost and the burdens of peacekeeping would be to employ something like a United Nations Emergency Peace Service, where we would be able to have a steady and reliable group of capable people from around the world to deploy at a moment's notice to hotspots where we can't afford the time, because of the sake of millions of people, to wait for a mandate or to wait for something that clearly hasn't been working for many years and in many cases has cost millions of people their lives.
But wouldn't these people have to, in some degree, become denationalized, as in the sense that, you know, if I'm a Canadian and I join this UN force, and for instance, they need to enforce an edict in Vancouver, I might say, hey, wait a minute. No, I'm not going to do that because that's sort of my area. Doesn't that cause a particular issue?
Yes, no, and but in this case, they'd be their main loyalty would be to the UN. These would be people from all over the world. These would be people from all regions, and with their main loyalty to the UN. So in a way, if you want to say it, that they would be denationalized, because they would be acting under the UN the UN flag and under UN, you know, auspices, and they would be almost like a global citizen, is as a World Federalist term, would be global citizens, and they'd be global citizens acting in the name of their brothers and sisters around the world. So in that case, they would in a way be denationalized, and that's the whole point of it, is to not have any one nation at the forefront of the crises. It would be all of us working together to help and save all of us together.
Maybe we've covered this in a way before, but so it's good. You've got this peacekeeping force. It goes out there. But I don't think Israel wants the peacekeeping service to interfere with its annexation of Palestine, or to be less provocative. The U.S. liked the fact that the U.N. was powerless to affect any change in South America during the Cold War. How aggressive would this force be? How effective would it be in challenging a superpower? We just had recently a whole bunch of issues about peacekeeping in Libya and Syria. You know, how do you deal with that?
Well, the answer to that is very simple, because it's a world and it's a federal system. And I think by meaning world, that's exactly what we're trying to do. And you just mentioned part of the problem that's the actual overall problem right now of global institutions is that they have nation state, you know, Egypt, United States, they're countries in and of it themselves, and they have their own agendas and their own national self-interest. So the forces themselves would be sort of like, in all shape, way, and form, loyal to the United Nations, and with enough sort of clout or enforcement or power, whatever, to go beyond any one nation's interest. Because again, we'd be acting in the name of a citizen, not in the name of a country. We'd be acting to save our fellow humans, not necessarily a fellow Egyptian or a fellow Canadian or a fellow Sudanese. It'd be a fellow human. And I think the whole premise behind world federalism is to have enough clout to go beyond the nation state system and enforce these policies and whatever laws at a supranational level, which is what today is lacking. We have pretty much, you know, everything is the box. I think what people it's often very frustrating as a world federalist, because people can't think beyond the nation state level. Like there's almost seems to be this gap at a world level, world government level, where people can't envision that there is an alternative to the present nation state way things are run. But as world federalists, we'd like to disagree. We agree to we want to raise the issue that there is an alternative, and that the status quo again is not an option, and that there is a need. There's a gap. There's almost like a vacuum at the global level in terms of government. And so the point of world federalism would be to go beyond the states, beyond any other nation, and say, well, you know what? You're not doing a really good job of dealing with this issue. Maybe the rest of the world community can give you a hand.
So I understand with what you're saying, this is early days and that sort of thing. But you there's one wall that you keep coming from. You say, well, you know, the nation state is going to become secondary, and that, you know, it's people will feel themselves belonging to the globe. That seems a pretty utopian, a pretty big give on that particular issue. I mean, people are well invested in the nation state for various reasons. That you would somehow have to create a global revolution that, barring, of course, the day the aliens come, seems to be a pretty high hurdle to jump.
No, I agree. And something that as world federalists, and that's a good point you raised, because it's a misconception that people have often of world federalism, and that I would like to very much address, is the fact that we see the brotherhood and sisterhood of humanity as one person and individuals. However, we respect and we actually like laud that we're a mosaic. So each of us is unique and individual, and of course we have our backgrounds that are very, very important, and we wouldn't be infringing on that. We wouldn't be saying, well, yeah, give up your Canadianness or your whateverness. It'll be actually we respect that. But at a global level, we have to actually, we're sometimes so caught up in noticing our differences as people. You have a different religion than me, you're a different skin color than I am, you're a different gender than I am. And that's, you know, at a certain point that's okay to identify as different. But I think as world federalists, we want to say, for so long we've been focusing on our differences that it's time that we focus on our similarities. And we wouldn't actually be saying, you know, you have to be a global citizen. We're just saying that we appreciate the mosaic, which is what it is. It's a mosaic of humanity, of the brotherhood and sisterhood of humanity. But at a point, we actually have to start maybe putting a bit more emphasis on how we're all similar, to get away from our differences that have caused so much problems. So we're not actually saying, you know, just become a world citizen and forget your backgrounds and your nationalities. On the contrary, we're saying it's wonderful, and it's what makes us unique, and it's what makes us what makes this world so special. But at one point, especially with globalization and how united we are in many ways, you know, because of our technology and our communications and our economy and the climate and everything, we're so united in many ways that we have to actually stop looking at our differences that divide us in this us versus them argument, and actually say, well, we're very similar in more ways than we're different, and let's tackle these problems that affect us all globally, regardless of our nationality. Let's tackle all these problems together.
Now, the World Federalists, just to go on a different, because time is running low.
Sure, yeah.
They sponsor a lot of different talks. I mean, that's one of the ways that the World Federalists came to my eyes, is that they had sponsored a lot of talks. I had asked one of my former co-hosts to join me on the show, and he refused to because apparently the World Federalists were supporting a talk about anti-vaccination group.
Okay.
Right? So, first of all, just to be fair, so what kind of cross-sponsorship what criteria do you have before you say, oh yes, we will help sponsor this or I'll help promote this particular group?
Well, as World Federalists, of course, we appeal to all sorts of interests and issues. And something that I think we always try to to state and emphasize is that it has to be tied with World Federalism somehow. So sometimes we're apolitical. Like, we don't take a stance one way or another on issues, and we welcome all sorts of opinions and interests. And some people come into our meetings thinking one thing, they listen to our speaker and they come out thinking another. And we don't actually advocate for one way or another. We're just kind of like a forum where people from different backgrounds and different interests and different groups can come together, and we can discuss, you know, different ideas and different topics and relate that with World Federalism somehow. So I would actually welcome your co-host to join us at our meetings, because I think it's a very good forum, like I said, for people to come together of different backgrounds and share and listen to each other as people, not really as you know, politically one way or politically another, but more as people, and just say, well, this is my background, this is where I come from, and you know, let's have a talk and let's see how we can, you know, we can make things better. And I think that's what World Federalism is about, is getting together and discussing how to make things better on a larger scale.
So, but if you sponsor a talk,
yeah,
what responsibility should you take about vetting the topic itself? I mean, in particular, anti-vaccination, you know, leads to children dying. So, I mean, there's a heavy moral thing. If someone came up to you and said, listen, I want to promote the idea of the differences between races, you know, at what point does a sponsor become morally responsible for the talks that they promote?
Well, I think there were, like with any organization, I think we just because we might differ in a certain opinion, we can't hold people back from arguing their point. And often enough, we do have an interview or like a little session with the presenter, and we, okay, well, what's your angle? Why are you doing this? And more often than not, we find that in the beginning, what seems to their talk might seem to be a certain course. In the end, when we get to the end of the presentation, they actually propose maybe a new form of something. Or so actually, sometimes we just have to give people a chance, you know, and they present, they do their presentation, and more often than not, people who are very conservative or very towards one opinion actually end up saying, well, yeah, maybe there might be another way to look at this, and not necessarily, they might not agree with it, but they understand it, and that's actually what we're about.
So I guess it's time for the last word, so to speak. So Vivian, you have the mic for a minute or so.
Thank you. I just wanted to also just promote that our World Federalist meetings do happen every third Thursday of the month at the Unitarian Church, which is 49th and Oak, at 7:30. And I'd like to leave you with a quote that's very powerful, and it was actually first introduced to me by a great World Federalist for over 50 years and a great friend of mine, Duncan Graham. He says that this quote he introduced to me is by Arudna Roy, and it goes, "Another world is not only possible, she is on her way. On a quiet day, I can hear her breathing." So just remember, everyone, the status quo is not an option, and there is an alternative, and I look very much forward to seeing more of you at our meetings. And thank you very much, Don, for the opportunity to be here tonight.
And again, thank you, Vivian, for joining me and enlightening my audience. Say goodbye.
Goodbye. Thank you very much, and good luck and good health to everybody, and Merry Christmas and Happy New Year.
This is Don saying, eyes open, minds on.
If you wish to make an apple pie from scratch,
must first invent the universe.
Thanks for listening to Radio Free Thinker. Remember to visit us online at radiofreethinker.com and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. If you have any local skeptical events you would like us to mention on the air, email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
Venture to the stars.